Ik snap dat je je podcast wil luisteren, dus ik zal het kort houden. Want als jij het belangrijk vindt om duurzame keuzes te maken, kan ASR misschien helpen. Nou hoor ik je denken, hoe dan? Nou, bijvoorbeeld bij het duurzaam herstellen van schade. Of de premies die we beleggen volgens ons duurzaam beleggingsbeleid. Dat bepaalt waar we wel en juist niet in investeren. Wil je meer weten over welke duurzame keuzes ASR maakt? Ga dan naar asr.nl/duurzamekeuzes. ASR doet het. Zo, dan kan je nu lekker naar je podcast luisteren.
Dit is het land van Leerde
Putin did not try this kind of provocation under the Trump administration.
Een podcast van de Telegraaf met analyses op het nieuws die u elders niet hoort.
We have a bad guy problem.
Which Dutch guy or Belgian girl or whatever is willing to die for Ukraine?
There are significant influence operations operating in your country today. Sophisticated.
Met Wierde en Robert Ophorst.
Ja, luister, is geen Robert Ophorst, maar met Wierduk in een extra podcast in het Engels. Met een heel speciale gast uit de Verenigde Staten. Dat is niemand minder dan Mary Kissel. Mary was special policy advisor voor de voormalige Amerikaanse minister van Buitenlandse Zaken, Mike Pompeo. Dus in de regering van president Donald Trump. Zij is nu senior policy advisor bij Stevens Inc. Mary Kissel is een veelgevraagde gast in Amerikaanse en Britse talkshows. Ze is de auteur van opiniestukken en ze is natuurlijk vooral een insider in de wandelgangen van het foreign policy establishment in Washington. We zijn enorm blij met haar aanwezigheid in deze show, want Mary Kissel weet alles over geopolitiek en in het bijzonder over China en Azië en de voormalige Sovjetlanden. Met haar gaan we het uitgebreid hebben over de crisis in Oekraïne, over de westerse relatie tot Rusland, over China dat met grote belangstelling dit conflict volgt en natuurlijk over de prangende vraag: hoe komen wij uit deze crisis? Mary, let's start. Of course, you're with us because of the crisis in Ukraine. We all know the situation by now. Vladimir Putin amassed a huge amount of military personnel and technology at the border with Ukraine. Russia is waging cyber warfare on Ukrainian government sites. Putin put down a whole list of demands, of security demands on the table at NATO headquarters. And in the meantime, we're trying to negotiate us out of this crisis. At this very moment, the Dutch government is deciding whether to send weapons to Ukraine. If you were their senior policy advisor, like you were for Mike Pompeo, what would you advise our government to do?
Well, I don't know if I can advise your government, but
well, let's try.
I'll tell you how we approached Moscow during our time in office. And by the way, for your audience, I do think it's notable to say that for those 4 years we had the President Trump in the White House and Secretary Pompeo at State, Vladimir Putin did not try the kinds of incursions that we saw under the George W. Bush administration into Georgia, under Obama into Syria and Crimea, and now, of course, the threat that he once again goes into Ukraine under Biden. How was that achieved? Well, frankly, we exerted an enormous amount of pressure on him, first and foremost by unleashing our energy supplies, which is one of the greatest weapons that you can wield against Putin. Because effectively, he's running a criminal gang, sitting atop a structure with, nuclear weapons and oil rigs. Mm-hmm. And so when the United States became, the marginal price setter for energy and the oil price dropped, that took away an enormous amount of leverage from Vladimir Putin. So that was one of the most important things we did. But we also made very clear, after, for instance, the Salisbury poisoning in the UK, we expelled 60 diplomats. Again, not well known or noted, but we also sanctioned several members of Putin's inner circle in retaliation for interference in our election process. We armed Ukraine with lethal defensive weapons, something that the Obama administration refused to do. And so we exerted pressure across many, many fronts, and we made clear this kind of incursion wouldn't be tolerated under us.
That's not the impression we had here in Europe. The impression we had here in Europe, I mean, a lot of people had here in Europe, was that Donald Trump was best friends with Vladimir Putin and that he was in Putin's pocket, isn't it?
Well, it just simply doesn't comport with the facts. What I'm giving you is not an opinion. I've just listed a series of actions and then observed the result, which is that Putin did not try this kind of provocation under the Trump administration because we made clear that there would be serious consequences if he did. I mean, just for instance, take those sanctions that I mentioned. In April of 2018, we sanctioned 7 Russian oligarchs, including Putin's son-in-law and the deputy governor of the Central Bank of the Russian Federation. This is really hitting him where it hurts, because what does Putin really value? He values the retention of his position and the empire that he has built for himself and his family. And so his worst fear is that he's unseated in a palace coup, and that he dies, that he dies a horrible kind of death like Gaddafi, right? So his goal is simply to stay in power and to make sure that the people around him are happy. And we threatened that. And therefore, he behaved. And unfortunately, what you're seeing right now is, I think, the result of several factors. Most importantly, a perception of American weakness and the weakness and the deterioration of American deterrence. And that's dangerous, not just for the United States, but for our friends in Europe and around the world.
Is he right when he thinks that America and probably also Europe are weak at the moment?
Well, he's making a calculation, clearly, that we are. Otherwise, why would he try this? And he has every reason to think so. I mean, look at the debacle of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Again, we took the troop levels down in Afghanistan from more than 10,000, and then we ratcheted it down to 2,500. But ultimately decided not to withdraw that force because we concluded that the stability of the country would be at risk. And so actually, Trump kept the troops in Afghanistan. He didn't want to, but we felt that was, unfortunately, a prudent measure based on the facts on the ground. So when you have a president who simply says, let's get out, and hands an entire country over to a terrorist organization, that sends a pretty clear signal to the Putins and the Xis of the world that you don't have a strong leader in power. And it's very, very dangerous.
Do you think the Afghanistan withdrawal has been a decisive moment for Putin?
I do. I think it sent a signal to rogue nations around the world that the United States was in retreat, that we did not cooperate or consult with our allies, because recall, too, that NATO was taken off guard by that withdrawal. But it's not just that. The administration in Washington is also now inching back toward dialogue with communist China without any kind of insistence on deliverables from the other side. So there have been multiple high-level meetings from the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Climate Change Advisor, the Commerce Secretary, the Treasury Secretary, you name it. And yet all we see is China concluding that they can do whatever they like. And so you see them threatening our athletes in Beijing. You saw Wang Yi dressing down our Secretary of State and saying, you can't interfere in the Olympics. You better be careful, effectively, is what he told him. And so you see a kind of confidence here in regimes that are antithetical to the West and the free world, feeling a kind of aggressiveness and confidence that I personally find very troubling. I think it's a seminal moment for Europe. And I think that this Ukraine test is going to be yet another pivotal moment. Will Europe get serious about supporting the United States, such as it is today, in pushing back and containing the threat from the likes of Vladimir Putin? This is a very, very important moment.
Well, of course, you know that Europe is divided. You know, the Germans take a completely different stance from, for instance, Great Britain, which is not in the European Union anymore. So what should Europe do? What should be the reaction of the United States and its allies in Europe?
Well, you mentioned Britain. I think Britain is a fascinating, fascinating case study in independent foreign policy making, uh-huh. because after Brexit, what have we seen? The UK is the only nation that has successfully put Vladimir Putin on the back foot. What do I mean by that? Well, when Foreign Secretary Liz Truss released intelligence alleging that Putin was going to put a puppet government into power.
Yeah, that was a nice one.
Well, that was the only time that we have seen the Russians backpedal. And uh-huh. they said, oh, no, you can't say that. That's fake news, misinformation, yeah. Disinformation. You can't do that. You can't do that. Well, that's exactly the sort of thing that Europe should be doing as well. There are all kinds of measures that we can take short of a shooting war to message to Vladimir Putin that it going into Ukraine would have significant consequences for him personally and for the people around him. That could range from any number of things. That could be the release of more intelligence information, for instance, about where Putin's homes are and his wealth. That would be damaging to him. That could be released inside of Russia. There could be a cyber signal sent. We could start to levy sanctions, not just on the smaller Russian banks like VEB, but we could say publicly, look, you do this, we're going to go after Sberbank and uh-huh. Gazprom Bank and, uh-huh. And the major financial institutions. We could look at where Russia has investments, significant investments overseas and partnerships. We have Western oil companies who have partnered with Russian counterparts, brought in their technology and their expertise. We can threaten that. We can move quickly to start to build LNG terminals in Europe, which is something that was underway, again, during the Trump years, but needs to be accelerated. That's not something that can be done in the short term, but we can certainly start putting that in process right now. And you see the administration doing it. Lots of things we can do.
This should have been done, of course, a long time ago, because now we are so much in Europe, we're so much dependent on Russian energy, isn't it?
But you know what? What a fantastic opportunity for a European leader, whether it's in the Netherlands or in France or somewhere else, to stand up and say, now is the time that we need to make this break. In fact, I think just purely from a political perspective, this is a fantastic time for someone to stand up and to claim that mantle. We haven't seen it happen yet on the continent, but were I advising someone, whether it was Macron or somebody else, this would be the moment to do it.
But you also know, of course, that Europe is divided. There's a lot of sympathy, actually, in left-wing and right-wing circles in Europe for Russia, for Putin. People who think that, you know, NATO overstretched in Eastern Europe and NATO should never, you know, accept membership of a former Soviet republics like Ukraine and Georgia. I suppose that from afar, from the United States, this is perhaps a strange sight, but that is the political reality here in Europe.
No, I think there are questions to be asked about the expansion of NATO, the role of NATO today, and what role we want it to play in the future. And I remember when President Trump, he made a kind of a throwaway comment. He said, would Americans go to die for, I think he said, Montenegro?
Yeah.
And he was absolutely castigated for that comment. But in fact, he was raising an important question, which is with 30 nations as members, with NATO in far-flung places around the world, is NATO becoming, like other multilateral organizations, an organization that is straying away from its original mission? And is it actually serving the member states that founded it?
So what do you think?
Well, I think there's not an easy answer to that question, but it's something that needs to be debated and discussed. It could very well be that it is in NATO's interest to admit a nation like Ukraine, which has clearly demonstrated a will to fight, which is leaning toward the West and actually has quite a bit to offer the West, should it ever be developed. Recall, it was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. It has many well-trained engineers and scientists and hardworking people. I mean, it could be that that is in NATO's interest, but that's a discussion that has really, never been seriously addressed But maybe, you know, look, I'm not sure that that's going to get settled today, but it is something that needs to be talked about.
Of course, it will not be settled today, but still it's very interesting. I mean, it's interesting to me because, of course, because of the open door policy, you cannot refuse, like, if states like Ukraine or Georgia want to join NATO. But in the interest of the West and in the interest of Europe, perhaps it would be better to say, okay, let's not do it. Let's not overstretch, like you say, because, of course, which Dutch guy or Belgian girl or whatever is willing to die for Ukraine, right? I mean, it, at the moment, it doesn't make sense. So shouldn't we be realpolitik here and tell Ukraine and Georgia for the moment just to back off and to understand that they are in the influence spheres of Russia, of the Kremlin?
Well, I mean, two observations. The first is that there's not just a black and white outcome here. We either send troops to help or we don't. We could be and should be and are surging in all manner of weaponry, supplies. We could be helping the Ukrainians with surveillance and intelligence. So there are plenty of ways that NATO can give Ukraine substantial support. And again, to your point that NATO is divided, we have seen Germany block certain NATO countries from providing that support. That needs to be addressed immediately. But secondly, you know, there's another interesting development here when it comes to cooperation between nations to counter threats. And that is two organizations, both in Asia Pacific, but can be applied to Europe, or that template could be used for Europe, which is the Quad mechanism between India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, and AUKUS, which is Australia, Britain, and the United States. These are informal groupings of nations that have the same values, that have the same shared threats, in that case from communist China, and they're coming together to cooperate across many areas in an informal, flexible mechanism. So it could also be that NATO becomes something that is sclerotic, too big, impossible to move quickly or to make important decisions together.
Too old-fashioned, maybe.
Turn out that way. Well, look, I, you know, I'm a big supporter of NATO. I want NATO to succeed. I think it's anchored transatlantic security. I think it's extremely important. It is more nimble than other multilateral organizations that exist today, but that's, I guess, not saying much. But my argument, Weird, is that there are also other ways that European nations could bind together to help Ukraine and to help Ukrainians defend their freedom. And we have that template in these informal groupings in Asia. And that's something else that I think that our European friends might want to consider.
That's interesting. Do you think that we Europeans are mentally equipped to deal with this kind of problems at the moment? Because, of course, the Russians, they think in spheres of influence, right? We don't. We think in human rights and, you know, stuff like that. Is that also a problem, being confronted with somebody like Putin, who thinks in empire in an almost 19th century old-fashioned way?
Well, I think it's important to talk about our values and to underscore our support for things like unalienable rights. That's something that we did a lot at the State Department. In fact, we convened a commission on unalienable rights. So it's deeply important to us. It's who we are. That being said, it has to be backed up by action. And so, you know, I remember going to the secretary many times with some statement, right, that some bureau wanted to put out on, you know, the value of human rights in this or that country. And the secretary would always say to me, okay, Mary, that's nice, but what are we doing about it?
Exactly.
So, you know, so take, for instance, China, right? We did a declaration of crimes against humanity and genocide against the Uyghurs because, but it wasn't just that declaration, which was, by the way, groundbreaking and has been followed by many nations around the world subsequently. We also sanctioned the officials who were responsible for that. We imposed visa bans. We raised awareness. We banned American companies from doing business with Chinese companies. like that were, you know, effectively engaging in that surveillance state and repression in Xinjiang. So, you know, we took action.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, if Europe really cares about European values and the European way of life, then at some point they will have to confront the fact that other nations are willing to change the facts on the ground. And are they? And if they aren't, are they willing to accept having Vladimir Putin control whether or not you get heating in the wintertime? I mean, that's really the question.
Well, Putin, of course, he knows all our weaknesses, and he also knows how hesitating we will be if there would be a military conflict in Ukraine. Do you think there's a real possibility that this conflict would become military, that there will be,
well,
really be war?
There's already a military conflict in Ukraine, and it's been going on for years. And luckily, from continental Europe's perspective, it has not resulted in the second and third order impacts that, for instance, the Syria conflict resulted in. Because uh-huh. recall, Europe was swamped with a million refugees, which also included some very bad actors who slipped in.
Absolutely.
And,
right.
And committed some very heinous acts of violence against innocent civilians in Europe.
Uh-huh.
So what I'm amazed at is that no one is discussing what the second and third order impacts of a Russian third invasion of Ukraine would actually mean. What would it mean for energy markets? What would it mean for refugees in Europe? What would it mean for the cybersecurity of major European corporations? What would it mean, in other words, for the daily life of average people walking around Germany and France and Italy and all of old Europe? Because I tell you what, Eastern Europe and the Baltic states are thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
They're thinking about it very seriously. They're uh-huh. very alarmed.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
That's the discussion that I think needs to be happening right now. Not is he going to invade or not? It's what does it mean for us? What is it going to mean in our daily lives? Because it could have quite significant negative implications for the daily lives of you and your colleagues, unfortunately.
I know. When you guys are assessing the possibility, right, of an all-out invasion, what would be the odds, do you think?
I always look at the past to inform predictions about the future. And Vladimir Putin is not a cipher. He clearly acts when he feels as if his position is threatened. So why did he invade Ukraine in the first place? Because he perceived a pro-democracy movement that would have served as an example to ordinary Russians, that they too could have the kinds of freedoms that the Ukrainians were very quickly establishing. And he calculated that he would not face opposition from the West, and he didn't. And so he was able to go in and seize. Same thing with Syria. When Barack Obama said that he set a red line and then actually showed that he didn't mean it, Vladimir Putin perceived that he could gain a strategic advantage and a position on the Mediterranean and expand his sphere of influence. And uh-huh. so that's what he did. So if we give him that opening now today, and we signal to him that NATO will not send in troops and we're going to be half-hearted about sending them supplies, that only encourages him to go in again.
Mary, if the Americans and Europeans have the right to, you know, defend their strategic interests, why don't the Russians have the same rights? They consider their influence in the former Soviet space, of course, as their strategic interest.
There's a difference between a democratic state with elected leadership that is responsive to its people saying, we're going to preserve our sovereignty and our national security, and a autocrat like Vladimir Putin, who has sustained himself through corrupt means and violence against not only his own people, but his neighbors, to change borders and to subjugate others. That is not comparing the apples and apples. These are apples and oranges. They're two entirely different things.
Uh-huh.
And recall, too, that it's not just about Ukraine, that bad actors around the world watch what we do. And so we're used to thinking about these conflicts as bilateral problems, right? Oh, the United States has a conflict with Russia or a conflict with China. That's not how it works, right? We have a bad guy problem. These guys talk to each other too. China and Russia draw closer. Iran sells oil to China. Pakistan supplies nuclear information to North Korea and to places like Saudi Arabia. So, you know, these things are all interconnected, and we also have to have a more sophisticated discussion about how these actors cooperate with each other to thwart our interests, because it's not just about nation to nation. It's about the free world versus nations that collectively do not share our interests or our strategic goals and do not share our vision of a peaceful future.
Of course. We'll come to China and Iran and Russia later. But first, let me ask, if you think, do the Americans, as far as you know, who are still involved in American foreign policy, do they think that there is any hopes for Russia to become one day a democracy and, you know, to become more Western, if you will?
I don't perceive any hope of that right now in Washington circles, unfortunately. But, you know, that's a very interesting question, because I think we, in the current administration, the Biden administration, they've also become accustomed to speaking only to the Russian leadership or to the Chinese leadership as if they represent the Russian or the Chinese people. But they do not. They are not elected in free and fair elections. And so recall, President Reagan used to speak over the former Soviet leadership. He'd speak directly to the Russian people. Mm-hmm. He'd say, I share your hopes and dreams. I want you to have a better future. I want you to enjoy the bounties like we enjoy here in the United States. And we share that goal for you. And that's a kind of a soft power, pro-freedom propaganda, if you will, that can be quite effective and that can be quite threatening to someone like Vladimir Putin. And it's a tool that has been abandoned, I think, over the past year. It's something that we were trying hard to do in the Trump administration, and that we would, you know, the Secretary of State would often speak to the people. He would separate the leadership from the people. I think it's something that needs to be revived.
And it's not something that the United States is doing at the moment.
No, it isn't.
Mm-hmm. We come to China because interesting, of course, is how China is looking at all this. It's what's happening. And I suppose that if China sees any weakness in the Western reaction, for them, that will be kind of an example that they can do whatever they want with the West. Is that also important in this crisis for the West to stay strong and to, you know, take a strong stance on Russia? Because in the end, there's always China, which is a much bigger threat, of course, to us.
Well, I'm not sure right now what's the bigger threat. I mean, you know, Russia, geographically speaking, is quite close to European capitals. It's not that far from Moscow to Vienna, if you look at a map. But, you know, look, I'm encouraged that the problem of communist China and the threat that it poses to the free world has been recognized. And in Washington, there's a bipartisan consensus. It is not a partisan matter that we need to worry about communist China. We need to take certain actions to protect our strategic industries and remove those supply chains from the mainland, and that we need to be on our guard. And this is a very new development. Recall, we had 40 years of Republican and Democratic administrations in Washington encouraging trade, engaging under the naive hope that somehow as China got rich, it would become more liberal and freer. And that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that awakening is happening in Europe too. And, you know, look, to its great credit, the Biden administration put together the US-EU Technology and Trade Council that built on the US-EU dialogue on China that we had started in the prior administration. I referenced the Quad and AUKUS in Asia Pacific. That is also, of course, a result of China's predations. So, you know, Europe may be a bit behind the United States and Australia in terms of their alarm, but certainly we cannot ignore the threat of communist China anymore. And when we're starting to take actions to counter it, and I think that's terrific. We're just at the beginning. You can think of it as sort of like the fight against the Soviets. maybe we're in 1952, right? It's the very early stages.
Interesting. And this has been initiated by the Trump administration.
Yes. I think this is something that's not deeply understood on the continent.
No.
But when President Trump got up and he said, look, and he really talked about it through the prism of trade initially. He said, you know, look, they cheat on all their trade deals. How is this fair? How is this free and fair trade? And he was kind of mocked for it because on the conservative right, the idea of trade is that it is always and everywhere good because it has benefits for both sides. And that's true, but it doesn't benefit you if you're enriching an enemy state. And that's what we were doing with communist China. And so, you know, through that kind of incessant rhetoric, I think there were a lot of people that had a realization and awakening that said, wait a second, actually, you know what? China is not engaging in a peaceful rise as a result of our trade. They have monopolized our supply chains. They have threatened not just their own people, which, of course, you know, it's one of the most brutal societies on earth. We always have to say this. It's the Chinese people who are the biggest victims here. But every day there are incursions of PLA ships around the Senkaku Islands. That's the sovereign territory of Japan. They have surrounded the sovereign territory of the Philippines. That is a treaty ally of the United States. They're engaging in very dangerous and threatening tactics in the South China Sea. They are intimidating the Vietnamese in Vietnamese waters. They killed a bunch of Indians on the Chinese-Indian border not so many years ago, brutalized them, threw them off of a cliff. These are not the actions of a peaceful state. This is an aggressive totalitarian power, and they are within our own societies. This is something that's very important that never gets talked about, but is starting to get talked about in the United States and in Britain, but it's in Australia. But it should be talked about more in the continent. There are significant influence operations operating in your country today. Sophisticated. Every level. Every level. CEOs, politicians, you name it. It's going on in the Netherlands today. And somebody needs to look at it because they are within your own borders.
Yeah, that's something we talked about earlier, isn't it? Well, not in this show, but about China operating in Western countries through media, through the internet, through buying like important people. Elaborate a bit on this. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, the Chinese Communist Party has what is called a magic weapon. It's the United Front Operations. And these are professional propagandists and influencers who fan out across the world. They identify prominent people or people who they think will become prominent and powerful in the future, and they try to co-opt them on behalf of China. So that takes many, many forms. It takes the form of traditional spying, which you would recognize from the Soviet days, but it's much more insidious than that. So take, for instance, friendship groups.
Yeah.
So these are organizations that take their marching orders from Beijing. In fact, they fly back and forth to mainland China, and then they come back to Europe or the United States or Australia.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
at universities,
they're in universities through the Confucius Institutes, propagandizing students.
Yes.
It is done through their actual propaganda organs, like China Daily or Xinhua News, that are allowed to print and to broadcast through things like CGTV. To present a vision of a peaceful totalitarian state. And I'm telling you, I find it absolutely astounding that our free press, whether they be European, American, or otherwise, when they go to China, they are heavily surveilled. They are prevented from going wherever they want to go, right? They are circumscribed to very small areas. They can only talk to the people that the Communist Party allow them to talk to. In many cases, they are harassed. In some cases, they've been beaten. And yet we allow China's propagandists to freely roam around and to propagandize our people. In the Trump administration, we declared these organizations foreign missions because they're not media outlets. They don't report to a private owner. They report to the Chinese government. I think they should be banned until the Chinese government allows our free press to operate in a free way within mainland China. I think that's fair and reciprocal treatment. And that is something that we should insist upon, because if we don't, they're just going to propagandize our people and they're going to prevent us from knowing what's actually going on within China.
Just the other week, there was a scandal here in Holland about an academic being sponsored by the Chinese and writing the favorable pieces about China. And this is known, and about the Confucius Institutes also, but perhaps it's not really known how deep they really established their influence in Dutch society. We talked about, Russia, China, Iran. Is it possible that the three of them together are like trying to push away American influence and Western influence and to establish an alternative for Western values and Western democracy? Because of this influence, of this propaganda influence, also from Russia and from China, more and more Western citizens are thinking about their system to be an attractive alternative for Western democracy.
We have to be proud of the free societies which we have built, fought for, and sustained. We cannot allow any kind of moral equivalence between our way of life and theirs. We need to say, frankly and often, our way of life is morally superior because we allow in continental Europe and the United States and the other democracies of the world, true human flourishing. And we have to say that clearly, and we have to be proud of it. And that is something that we have moved away from in the United States, in particular with wokeism and that movement here. Uh-huh. And it's a cancer, and it's weakening us, and it's weakening our resolve. And it is making us more vulnerable to the propaganda of an Iran or a Russia or a China to say, well, you know what, maybe their way of life is kind of okay because, China is pulling people out of poverty. But what that argument ignores is not how many people they have pulled out of poverty, but how many people communist China has prevented from being pulled out of poverty. We should not be asking and marveling at China's quote-unquote economic miracle. We should be disgusted at how many hundreds of millions of people that they have suppressed and prevented from becoming rich. China today should look like Taiwan. It should have the freedoms. It should have the quality of life. It should have the average income of a Taiwan or a South Korea. We should ask, why does that gap exist? And we know the answer. It exists because a small cabal of people at the top of the Communist Party structure just want to hold on to their power and their corrupt gains, and they will do whatever it takes to do it. It's as simple as that. It's the same story in Syria, in Iran, in Russia, and in China. These are human beings who are corrupt, brutal autocrats who are acting for their own selfish ends, and in doing so are preventing their own people from flourishing, but also posing a threat to us and our superior way of life. And that's how we need to frame it, and that's how we need to respond to it.
You mentioned wokeism. Isn't wokeism an internal threat now to our democracies?
Yes.
And how will this end up? What do you think? What are the chances of wokeism becoming dominant in our societies?
Well, here in the United States, we're seeing a pushback, in fact. Take, for instance, our elections, our local elections in Virginia, where you had a new governor elected. His name is Glenn Youngkin, who ran explicitly on an anti-woke platform, specifically rejecting wokeism in public schools, saying, we're going to teach our history, the good parts of it and the bad parts of it. But we're not going to teach our children that America is an inherently racist society, because that's simply not true. We need to acknowledge that, yes, we had slavery and we had many bad things that happened, but America is a wonderful nation. It's an ongoing experiment, and we're always striving to be better. And that is the uniqueness of America, that our experiment continues and it's constantly improving and constantly changing for the better. And that's why that's why so many people want to come to our nation and why we continue to have people surging in as immigrants, because they recognize this. So, you know, you saw tens of thousands of police officers come out to protest against the, you know, the woke soft on crime policies here in New York City, which have resulted in the deaths of, you know, the unnecessary deaths of many, many people, in mostly poor communities. So I think there is a backlash that is brewing, at least here in the United States. I can't speak for Europe.
Well, Europe is always a bit later, of course. And there is lots of tensions because of this wokeism, you know, in our universities, in our media, and in our politics also. So the clash is coming, I think. Is there a chance that because also of this, the battle against wokeism, let's say, that Donald Trump will make a reappearance in, what's it, like 3 years from now?
I don't know. I mean, that's always the big kind of guessing game in politics. But, you know, look, I think what the Virginia election showed is that you just never know who's going to appear on the American political scene. We have an incredibly dynamic political system. And it could be that President Trump comes back. He has a very strong following in the United States because, frankly, he produced the strongest economy and the safest world that we have seen in recent decades. And so there are a lot of people that miss that, and rightly so. It could be that one of his protégés, whether it's my former boss, Mike Pompeo, or Ron DeSantis, or someone else, emerges. Or you could have someone come completely out of the blue, like Glenn Youngkin. I mean, Glenn Youngkin was not a national figure in the United States until about 6 months ago. Nobody knew his name. So I think it's kind of early days to say this person or that person is going to be the nominee or will lead, you know, the conservative movement in the United States. I just think it's too early to tell.
Yeah, but at the moment, it's still Donald Trump who's leading this movement, isn't it?
I think there are many people who lead the movement, honestly. And in fact, the Republican Party has many questions that it is struggling with. For instance, what kind of immigration policy do conservatives support? Do conservatives still support free trade? If so, what kind? Do conservatives want to use government to spend money on the things that conservatives support? Or do they want to be more like Reagan? Do conservatives support a kind of democratization campaign abroad like George W. Bush did? Or do conservatives want nothing to do with places like Ukraine? You had Senator Josh Hawley from the U.S. Senate come out just in these recent days and say, you know what, the United States shouldn't be involved in Ukraine, and he's a Republican. So, you know, there are many, many big questions being asked on the right in the United States that really, really haven't been resolved. And these are very important questions. So it's not just Democrats who are arguing about the direction of their party. That's happening to Republicans, too.
Okay. Let's wrap up with Russia, then. How do you think this crisis will evolve, and how will it end?
I think it is positive that the United States and Europe are cooperating together to move troops and supplies to defend the borders and to start to supply Ukraine with the weapons and aid that it needs if it will need to fight. Much more needs to be done.
So that is your advice to our government, right? Send them weapons.
Send them everything that they need. And send them more than you think that they need. And then make it as painful as possible for Putin to make the calculation whether or not to go in. That is the real question. Will Europe and the United States work together to raise that pain level so high that Putin concludes that he cannot go in? In many cases, the question is not really what Putin will do. It's what will the free nations of the West force him to do? That's the question.
Thank you very much. Well, we will see how this question will be answered by our elites, as we say. Mary, thank you so much for your insights and for your time.
It was a real honor and pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much, Mary, and thank you for being in our show.